Welcome to The Debate. You know, usually when we talk about a diagnostic assessment, we expect absolute precision.
Right, like engineering.
Exactly. It's like you break a bone, the x-ray shows a jagged white line on the monitor, and the doctor just points at it and says, well, there it is. That's the problem.
Yeah, it's totally binary. The bone is broken or it's not. It's a clean, localized issue.
Right. And that kind of clarity is incredibly comforting. We desperately want our problems to be visible, to be, you know, perfectly categorized. But then you step out of the orthopedics ward and into the world of complex, dynamic living systems.
Which is a whole different ballgame.
Completely. Whether you're looking at a multi-organ failure patient in the intensive care unit, or say a collapsing coral reef in the Pacific, or even a fragile global financial network, suddenly that simple x-ray machine is utterly useless.
Oh, absolutely useless.
We find ourselves looking at a diagnostic landscape that is honestly profoundly murky. We can't tell if the system is thriving or secretly dying. So today, we're exploring a work that tries to build a new kind of x-ray for those complex systems. We're looking at Dr. Bechara Saheli's transdisciplinary monograph, The Dynamic Architecture of Viability.
And, I mean, it's hard to overstate just how ambitious this piece of work is. The text essentially proposes a minimal cross-scale grammar of life. It's searching for the underlying rules that govern everything from single cells to entire human societies.
It really is staggering in its scope. So the central question we are debating today is this. Does mapping the biological and social functions of life onto exceptional mathematics, specifically abstract structures like the Fano plane, the Octonians, and the E8 Lie group, does that provide a genuinely predictive structural science of viability? Or does it overextend mathematical formalism into the messy, historical reality of living systems?
And that is the profound tension sitting right at the center of the text. It's exactly where the sheer elegance of math collides with the mud and blood of evolutionary biology.
Exactly. I'll be arguing that this exceptional mathematical architecture represents a genuine scientific breakthrough. I think it provides a necessary, exact, and falsifiable matrix that finally unifies biological action with physical constraint.
And I will be taking the opposing view today. I'm going to argue that while the biological synthesis in this monograph is profound, the mapping to exceptional Lie groups is an elegant but potentially misleading heuristic, one that risks confusing formal mathematical symmetry with living, breathing history.
Well, let me lay out exactly why I see this as such a massive paradigm shift. Dr. Saheli argues that the viability of any living system absolutely cannot be understood by looking at its isolated parts. You can't just weigh the organs and understand the organism.
Right.
Instead, viability has to be understood through the continuous, recursive circulation of seven distinct functions. And those are constraint, margin, state, disturbance, perception, regulation, and options.
And just to ground that for a second, those aren't just arbitrary categories. Every living thing has to manage its physical constraints, perceive its environment, regulate its internal state, and, you know, maintain a margin of safety against disturbances.
Precisely. But the true breakthrough of this monograph isn't just making a list of seven biological functions. The breakthrough is mapping those seven functions onto the Fano plane.
Okay, here we go.
Yeah. For our listeners, the Fano plane is the simplest possible finite projective plane in geometry. If you want to visualize it, just imagine a simple triangle with a circle perfectly inscribed inside it.
Got it.
On that figure, you have exactly seven distinct points and seven lines connecting them, with every single line containing exactly three points. When you map the seven biological functions onto those seven points, they form these perfect triadic closures.
Right. They interlock.
They interlock perfectly. It gives us a strict relational matrix that prevents us from making category errors. And it reveals hidden systemic vulnerabilities. It essentially proves that life actually follows a rigorous geometric grammar, not just qualitative descriptions. We're no longer just telling ourselves stories about how systems adapt. We are looking at the foundational math of survival.
Okay, so I am fully with you on the first half of that. I agree that those seven functions serve as an exceptional, even revolutionary diagnostic checklist for biological and institutional systems. But where I diverge, and honestly where I think the text itself actually cautions us if we read closely, is what it calls the exceptional ascent into eight-dimensional octonionic composition and beyond. mathematical structures like the Fano plane or the E8 Lie group. They're characterized by exact, timeless, frictionless internal relations. They are immortal.
Well, they're mathematical.
Right, but living systems rely on completely different principles. They rely on what we call inverse Darwinism, on evolutionary drift, on historical redundancy, and excess messy capacity. Forcing biology into exceptional algebra risks prioritizing aesthetic elegance over empirical reality. I mean, we have to remember the golden rule of systems theory. The map is not the territory.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective on the Fano plane specifically, because I think it proves why this is so much more than just a pretty aesthetic overlay. Let's really look at the foundational premise here, moving from the abstract to the applied geometry.
Okay.
The Fano plane is built on a binary construction, using a three-dimensional binary vector space. Every point is completely interlocked. Treating these seven functions through the Fano plane is literally like discovering the periodic table for systemic failure.
The periodic table? I mean, that's quite a claim.
But think about how the periodic table works. If you swap out one proton, you don't just have a slightly different lump of matter, you change the entire elemental category. The Fano plane does that for viability. Let's test it using the text's own clinical example, which is septic shock.
A great example.
Right. Now, septic shock isn't just a bad infection. It's a catastrophic, multi-system disturbance where the body starts failing across the board. If we use the Fano triads, we can look at a specific line on that triangle, the interaction of constraint, margin, and state.
Ah, the CMS triad.
Exactly. Constraint, margin, and state. In a clinical ICU setting, a patient might have a perfectly normal blood pressure reading on the monitor. That blood pressure is their state.
Right. And if a doctor only looks at the state, they might think the patient is fine.
Exactly. But that normal blood pressure is masking an entirely exhausted physiological reserve, their margin. Why? Because they're on massive doses of adrenaline and vasopressor medications, which represent an artificial constraint. The geometric triad forces you to look at all three points on the line simultaneously.
It forces the doctor to see the hidden margin depletion.
Yes. It's like looking at a chemical equation and, you know, realizing you are missing an oxygen atom. It proves these biological relations are structurally, mathematically bound together.
Okay, I will absolutely give you the clinical power of that septic shock example. It really is brilliant. Using constraint, margin, and state as a triad is an incredible way to conceptualize hidden vulnerability.
Thank you.
But here is my sharp pushback, and this is grounded directly in the text. The Fano plane's incidence is perfectly symmetric. Every point and line relates to the others in an entirely equivalent, balanced way. But biological causality is deeply, inherently asymmetric.
What do you mean by asymmetric in this context?
Well, let's look at another triad on that same Fano plane. What the text calls the generative triad: constraint, perception, and regulation. Let's walk through how that actually works in biology. Constraints shape the physical environment and determine what can even be sensed. Perception then takes those differences and makes them available to the organism as information.
Right.
Then regulation takes that information and physically changes the system's state. That is a specific, directed, one-way flow of causality. Disturbance acts as a forcing field upon it. If you apply a perfectly symmetric geometry, like the Fano plane, to a fundamentally directed, asymmetric biological process, you are requiring a manual interpretive overlay.
Ah, I see what you're saying.
Right? The asymmetry, the actual forward arrow of life, doesn't emerge naturally from the math. You, the observer, are manually injecting the arrow of time into a timeless geometric object. The math isn't predicting the biology. You're just using the math as a very sophisticated filing cabinet.
Okay, I appreciate the distinction. And it's a completely fair critique of the Fano plane in isolation. Yes, the incidence of the Fano plane is symmetric and static, but the formalism of this monograph does not stop at static geometry.
Sure.
That is exactly why the architecture requires what the text calls the algebraic lift-up to the octonions. If the Fano plane gives us the static grammar, the nouns, the octonions introduce the verbs. They introduce dynamics, composition, and crucially, the order of operations.
Wait, let's pause for a second. For our listeners who haven't looked at eight-dimensional algebra lately, we really need to unpack what moving to the octonions actually does. You're saying this jump to an eight-dimensional number system solves the biological problem of time and direction?
I am, specifically because of a property called the associator equation. In normal math, multiplication is associative. You know, 2 times 3 times 4 is the same no matter how you group them. But in the octignons, multiplication is non-associative. Mathematically, the associator is defined as A times B times C minus A times the product of B and C.
And in plain English?
In plain English, the order in which you group things completely changes the final result. It's like putting on your socks and then your shoes versus putting on your shoes and then trying to put on your socks.
Right.
The elements are the same, but the sequence dictates viability. I argue this exact mathematical non-associativity perfectly models what we call lawful context or path dependence in living systems. Let's go back to our organism. If an organism perceives a threat, regulates its internal state, and then utilizes an escape option, that yields a radically different real-world outcome than if it, say, randomly utilizes an option, perceives a threat too late, and then tries to regulate.
Yeah, of course.
Doing things in a different order alters the organism's survival. That is the very definition of a historically structured living entity. The math actually predicts the path dependence.
Okay, it's an incredibly seductive idea. I completely understand why you're drawn to it, but I'm sorry, I just don't buy that it's a literal mapping.
Why not?
Let me tell you why. You are taking a profound biological truth, the fact that history and sequencing matter, and you are conflating it with a formal algebraic property. Non-associativity in the octonions is a permanent, static, mathematical law. It is true everywhere all at once in that mathematical space. Path dependence in biology, however, is a product of something entirely different. It's a product of structural coupling, of memory, and of learning over time.
But they both result in sequential dependence.
Yes, but the mechanism is entirely different. Think about a tree growing around a steel fence. Over decades, it builds up physical sedimentations of its history. It physically adapts to the constraint. A cell or a human society learns and alters its own future architecture based on past trauma. To say that biological memory and adaptation is just an expression of octonian non-associativity is a dangerous category error.
A category error?
Yes. It confuses a timeless algebraic property, which never learns and never changes, with the biological accumulation of history. The living organism actually changes its own internal constraints over time. The octonians never, ever change their rules.
Will, I see the distinction you're drawing between mathematical laws and physical accumulation. But if the formal rules map so cleanly onto the operational reality, why dismiss it as a mere category error? Instead of debating the abstract algebra, let's test these concepts against real-world macro-scale crises.
Okay.
Because if this exceptional math works, it shouldn't just explain a cell. It should explain human institutions. Let's look at the institutional scale, specifically the text's example of a global financial crisis.
Ah, economics, the perfect example of where abstract mathematical models frequently and spectacularly fail us.
Well, I would argue exactly where we desperately need a fundamentally better one. Think back to the 2008 housing crisis. The standard metrics and finance were completely blind to the impending collapse. Why? Because standard metrics just look at stable asset prices. They were only looking at the state of the market. The mortgage-backed securities looked fine. But Dr. Sali proposes something in the text called the altimeter.
The global relational invariant.
Exactly. It's a diagnostic tool based on quartic forms, like those found in a Frutenthal triple system, which sits higher up on this exceptional mathematical ladder. If we had a mathematically unified quartic invariant running in our financial systems, it wouldn't just measure asset prices. It can mathematically detect the silent erosion of trust, the loss of margin, and the narrowing of options long before the actual collapse occurred.
Wow.
Right? It pulls all 7 of those core functions into one rigorous diagnostic tool. This isn't just a metaphor for stability. It is a proposed structural measurement of system degradation.
I actually love that you brought up the altimeter because I come at it from a completely different way. There is a profound mathematical contradiction sitting right there in the source material.
which, to its absolute credit, the text explicitly acknowledges.
What contradiction?
Well, you mentioned the Frutenthal triple systems and the quartic invariant. In this exceptional mathematical ladder, an E7 transformation, which is a specific type of mathematical operation, preserves that quartic invariant exactly.
Right. The preservation of that invariant represents the conserved viability of the whole system.
But think about what that means mechanically, logically. Think of an E7 transformation like a perfectly sealed, frictionless gyroscope spinning in a vacuum. It never loses energy. It preserves its state flawlessly forever. But a financial crisis is like a gyroscope covered in rust, violently grinding to a halt.
I mean, sure.
If an E7 transformation preserves a quartic invariant exactly, it fundamentally cannot be used to model a system that is actively degrading. You cannot use the math of a frictionless, immortal object to measure a financial system that is bleeding out and dying, not without breaking the rules of the mathematical group itself.
But
if the financial system is failing, the invariant isn't invariant anymore. So logically, either you are using chaotic dynamics completely outside the preserving E7 group, in which case, why invoke the exceptional math at all? Or this altimeter is just a loose empirical statistic that is merely inspired by the geometry. It cannot literally be the exact invariant itself.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning because you're assuming the invariant must represent infinite perfect health of a single isolated object. That's not what viability means in this framework. The invariant represents the relational conditions of viability across the whole field.
Okay, explain that.
Let's stick with the financial system. If a banking sector begins to export its damage, say by transferring toxic costs to households or future generations, just to maintain its own balance sheet, it is preserving its own local subsystem at the expense of the larger environment.
Right.
The math allows us to see how local stability is maintained by consuming unmeasured options elsewhere. The invariant holds the complete system accountable, revealing that the rust, as you call it, hasn't disappeared. It was just pushed off the balance sheet.
But notice what you just did there. You were shifting the goalposts from pure mathematics to ethics and human behavior. The math simply says a mathematical value is preserved, but the biological and social reality says the coral reef is bleaching or the middle class is going bankrupt.
It is not a shift at all. It is an integration. And honestly, that brings us to what I consider the most ambitious, breathtaking part of the entire synthesis, the triune aspect process monism. Because all these structural models, whether it's a failing hospital patient or a failing economy, are ultimately experienced by someone.
Right. There is a lived experience.
Exactly. A financial crash isn't just a math error on a ledger, it's felt human panic, which forces us to ask the ultimate question: how does this abstract geometric map account for subjective conscious experience?
And this is exactly where I think the synthesis stretches its mathematical metaphors to the absolute breaking point.
Just hear me out on this, because the geometry here is stunning. The text uses spin 8, triality, as its core analogy for consciousness. Spin 8 is an exact mathematical symmetry that features three distinct inequivalent representations, but they all preserve a deeper underlying symmetry. It's like a single die that somehow has three distinct faces that all roll together simultaneously.
Okay. Dr. Sahali argues that just as spin 8 has these three faces, reality itself presents in three irreducible windows. Intrinsically, which is the first-person I, or subjective feeling, participatorily, which is the second-person you, or relational co-regulation, and extrinsically, which is the third-person it, or physical structure. I argue the structural correspondence actually solves the hard problem of consciousness.
Solves the hard problem?
Yes. It shows that subjective feeling, what philosophers call valence, and physical structure are not two fundamentally different substances. They are just different mathematical aspects of the exact same formal relational matrix. Unified felt valence is simply the intrinsic aspect of integrated living regulation.
It is a beautifully constructed, deeply poetic philosophical proposition. Truly. But I have to push back strongly on this being a metaphysical identity hypothesis. Spin 8 mathematics absolutely does not entail subject, other, and world.
It maps perfectly, though.
But there is no canonical mathematical isomorphism that magically maps three chiral spinner representations onto human first, second, and third person experiential domains. It is a metaphor, a brilliant one, but still a metaphor. And more importantly, if we are talking about human experience,
let's look at the ultimate ethical test the text itself proposes, the concept of life coherence and the biology of love.
Right, drawing on Humberto Maturana's concept of love.
Exactly. The text defines love technically, biologically, as the emotioning that preserves the other as a legitimate other in coexistence. It acts as a relational, generative, margin-protecting participation and honoring difference. The text even points explicitly to the greatest commandment, loving God, loving your neighbor, and loving yourself, as a relational grammar to judge whether a system is truly conserving life or just cannibalizing it.
Yes.
My overarching point today is this. Love, forgiveness, and ethical life coherence cannot be derived from lie groups. You simply cannot find the greatest commandment embedded inside a quartic invariant. They require embodied human judgment, shared vulnerability, and mutual answerability.
I say the emotional weight of that argument, I really do. But I don't think the text is claiming you can derive human love from an algebraic equation. It is saying that the exceptional mathematical ladder provides a necessary formal discipline to ensure we aren't just telling ourselves subjective, comforting stories about how life works.
Okay, fair.
The dynamic architecture of viability successfully relocates the great mysteries of consciousness, of systemic resilience, and even of relational ethics into a common, falsifiable architecture. It forces us to see that an extractive, predatory financial system and a localized biological tumor follow the exact same grammatical failure pattern. They both conserve their local state by destroying their life ground. The math doesn't replace our human judgment. It illuminates the structural reality, so our ethical judgment isn't flying blind.
I can certainly agree that the biological synthesis in this work, especially the profound linkage of margin, perception, and regulation, is an absolute masterpiece of systems theory. It really does give us a desperately needed language to diagnose systemic entrapment across disciplines.
Absolutely.
But the empirical standing of the Fano to E8 mapping remains highly conjectural. We must never mistake the pristine map of exceptional mathematics for the living, breathing historical territory. Life is asymmetrical. It is messy. It is deeply dependent on drift, error, and redundancy. Math is timeless and exact. They can speak to each other, but they are not the same thing.
Well, we clearly have a continued fundamental disagreement over the ontological reality of these mathematical structures. Are they literally instantiated in the living organism, or are they just highly effective metaphorical modeling tools? But I think we find deep, meaningful convergence on the necessity of that life value test. We both wholeheartedly agree with Dr. Saheli's conclusion that no system, no matter how mathematically elegant, profitable, or internally stable it appears, is truly viable if its internal coherence survives by transferring disabling costs to other lives or ecosystems.
Absolutely. I mean, a system can be perfectly coherent in its own localized regulatory loop while systematically destroying the planet it lives on. That is exactly where the third-person mathematics and the second-person ethics must meet. We have to approach these towering biological and social challenges through multiple windows. The subjective feeling of human pain, the relational reality of societal trust, and the rigorous public measurement of resources are all equally required. You can't leave any of them out.
And that suggests there is so much more for our listeners to explore in Dr. Saheli's monumental synthesis. It challenges us to stop looking for simple binary answers. To circle back to where we started our conversation today, that crisp, clear X-ray we all desperately want when a complex system breaks down, it just doesn't exist. The diagnostic waters of living systems are complex, they are recursive, and they are deeply intertwined with our own values and history. We leave it to you to decide whether exceptional mathematics provides the ultimate illuminating light in those waters, or if life's messy history defies perfect geometric symmetry. Thank you for joining us on The Debate.